you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hello, and thanks for tuning into the podcast today. I'm constantly in search of the highest impact skills that you can learn that will have a disproportionate effect on your life. The lead dominoes that make everything else easier. And after interviewing our guest this week, I went ahead and picked up his book, and I could quickly tell that it should be required reading in high school. It's one of those that will make you successful in virtually every endeavor in life. And if you're a parent, it's one of the greatest gifts you can give your kids. Plus, the method is absolutely free. And that book is called De-Escalate. Sharing that with us this week is our guest, Doug Knoll. Doug left a successful career as a trial lawyer to become a peacemaker. His calling is to serve humanity, and he executes his calling at many levels. He's an award-winning teacher, author, trainer, and a highly experienced mediator. Doug's work carries him from international work to helping people resolve deep interpersonal and ideological conflicts, to training life inmates to be peacemakers and mediators in maximum security prisons. And in this episode, we'll share his simple process to diffuse even the most tense situations in 90 seconds or less. And if it works in maximum security prisons, it'll work in any of your relationships. The people you use it on will feel more heard, more understood, and connect with you on a deeper level. Yes, I know that's a tall promise, but stay tuned and try it for yourself. You can find the show notes to this one at mindbodypeak.com/59. If this conversation interests you, Doug has a special package you can check out. Just go to dougknoll.co/nick-urban. That's dougknoll.co/nick-urban. With that out of the way, let's dive in. Doug, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while now.
Great, Nick. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So for anyone who isn't convinced that this is something they need to work on, how would you sell the importance of becoming a better conversationalist and learning to de-escalate in 45 seconds?
This is a foundational skill of life, and we think that we know how to listen to people, but we don't. And when you learn the things that we're going to talk about here and master them, your life will transform forever. And you want to talk about peak performance, peak mental performance? This is the skill that will lead you to peak mental performance for a whole bunch of different reasons that we'll get into.
And it's also the way that you organize people, you lead, you coordinate.
Correct. It is, like I said, it's a foundational skill of life. Without this skill, you'll be like everybody else, oftentimes confused by people's behaviors, not knowing how to respond, not knowing what's really going on, guessing a lot. And all that goes away. The confusion, the chaos, it all goes away. You'll be able to stop. You'll never have a fight or argument again in your life using these skills.
That's a big promise.
I will deliver.
We'll unpack that more in 1 second. But first, we'll warm up with the non-negotiable or unusual things you've done so far for your health and performance.
Well, at a physical level, I was born a mess. I was born pretty severely disabled. I was born almost blind, crippled, 2 club feet, couldn't walk until I was 3 years old, partially deaf, left-handed, bad teeth. I mean, you name it, I had a lot of problems, and I had to overcome a lot of barriers. And I was fortunate that my parents Well, fortunate and unfortunate. I was fortunate that I grew up in affluence and my parents exposed me to a lot of different stuff. But the unfortunate problem was that back in those days, in the 1950s, people had no clue how to deal with somebody like me, a kid like me. So I did not get a lot of emotional support. And it was I was very slow at learning motor skills. But ultimately, I overcame all of them. And I learned that fitness is really important. And even today, I'm 71. I don't look it, and I don't act it, and I'm not. It's my chronological age. My biological age is probably 10 or 15 years younger. But I've been very active in my life as a whitewater guide, class 4 kayaker, level 3 certified ski instructor. I'm a pilot, secondary black belt. I mean, I've accomplished a lot. The way you do that, the way you make those accomplishments is just pick one thing and work at it every single day until you get it. And don't get diverted off to other stuff. That's why I never picked up golf. I never wanted to spend the 3,000 to 5,000 hours it would take me to be a good golfer, because that's what it takes. And so today, what's non-negotiable for me today is, one, getting exercise every single day, working with a personal trainer once a week, full body workout to full exhaustion, and making sure that I eat really clean. So mostly organic, not a lot of red meat. My only advice is whiskey.
It's a good one to have.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So tell me about what your specialty is and how you got there.
So I'm a lawyer turned peacemaker, and that may sound interesting. I basically help people solve deep and intractable conflicts, often ideological conflicts, where lawsuits are not an option and there's a lot at stake, oftentimes wealth, money, status. And I'm called into these conflicts to help people get this stuff through. Before I did that work, and I've been doing that work for over 22 years, I was a trial lawyer, civil trial lawyer, and did that for 22 years. Went back to school, got my master's degree in peacemaking and conflict studies, left the practice of law to become a peacemaker. And that's what I do today. And along the way, I developed some really innovative, counterintuitive skills for calming people down, because there was nothing out there that I had found that was workable. So I figured out, using neuroscience, I figured out a way to do that. And that led me also to co-found the Prison of Peace Project with my colleague Laurel Coffer in 2010. And since that time, we go into maximum security prisons and train lifers and long-termers and murderers how to be peacemakers to stop prison violence. And it's been enormously successful. We're in 15 California prisons, 12 prisons in Greece, prisons in Connecticut. We've got startups in Italy and in Nairobi, Kenya. And we, during the pandemic, we filmed the entire curriculum. So, and we're in post-production right now. So I'm in the process of writing up all the manuals. By midsummer, Prison of Peace will be available to anybody in the world who wants to take the curriculum into their prisons or jails or reentry programs or domestic violence shelters, places like that, where people can learn how to really be true peacemakers.
That's a noble undertaking and very much needed.
Yeah, it's really cool. Hard work, but really cool.
Yeah. What do you gain from solidifying your emotional skills and competency, even if you're 40, 70, 80 years old and your childhood is long behind you? What tangible benefits do you experience then?
Let's start with the children, because I really want to focus on that. If parents start affect labeling their kids at, say, 3 or 4 years old, studies show that by the time they're 10 or 11, they're 2 grade levels ahead of their peers.
Wow.
That's how powerful it is. As adults, what do you learn? First of all, you'll never have a fight or argument again. Literally, no more conflict. Put me out of the job. You will increase your capacity for compassion. You will be able to walk into a room and read the room and know exactly emotionally where everybody is coming from. Nobody will confuse you anymore. You will no longer see irrational behavior. You'll see it simply as emotions. And since you're able to read the emotional data fields, you'll know exactly what people are saying. You'll know exactly what to say, when to say it, and how to say it in any situation, no matter how intense. So you gain utter confidence in your social skills. If you're single and you're dating, you now have the ability to give your date the one thing that person desires more than anything else. And it's not love, sex, or money. It's being listened into existence. And you'll have that ability. If you're a leader, you'll become a leader that everybody wants to follow. At the same time, inside yourself, you'll have a much deeper sense of calm. And you'll always be centered. Rarely will you get knocked off balance. Mm-hmm. And once you have that calm, then, you know, obviously you're not being reactive to whatever emotions come up in you. You can be aware of your emotions and either react to them or not. It'll be your choice what you want to do, but you won't be triggered by stuff. The other thing that happens that I don't talk about this too much, is that when you affect label somebody, you move into a state of transcendence. You become egoless. And you become one, you really experience, it's a physical experience of sort of being of being one with the universe. It's this almost a spiritual practice.
Wow.
And that's really, it's a really interesting phenomena to experience. It's what Eckhart Tolle talks about, but doesn't teach us how to do it, right?
Yeah.
He's all about the what, not about the how, which is why I don't like his work. But the presence of now, when you affect label somebody, you really drop into that present moment. And there's some really interesting research that's been done around the concept of ego, which is a Freudian concept that is totally discredited. There's nothing about Freud that's right. But there are we have two parts of our brain. What you could, if just to use it colloquially, the small ego and the big ego, different parts of the prefrontal cortex. And when we're involved in a me, one part of the lower part of the prefrontal cortex is activated and the upper part is deactivated. But when we become transcendent for the big me, the transcendent me, the lower part of the prefrontal cortex is deactivated and the upper part is activated, and we get this experience of transcendence. And that's pretty interesting. And you can trigger that by listening to and reflecting back somebody else's emotions.
So simple.
So simple. And you know something, Nick, this is a tool that is priceless, effortless, easy, and costs you nothing. It costs you nothing to do this. And you go around and you listen people into existence, you validate their feelings, you make them feel deeply heard, and you're throwing a little pebble into the pool of peace. And the ripples start to flow out. And if enough people start doing this, just like we see in our prisons, the ripples of peace change everything. And it's phenomenal to watch, which is why I'm so passionate about it.
I first discovered this when I began studying and realizing the importance of communication, but I took a weaker approach, and I would affect label someone, but I would weaken it with, it sounds like,
yes,
it feels like, I'm hearing you say, and it's not as powerful. And I thought that was a better approach until I talk to you.
Right. And let me explain why we do that. We do it because we're soothing our own anxiety. And we are also afraid of being rejected. We're afraid that we're going to be perceived as manipulative or patronizing. What do you mean telling somebody else how they feel? That's just rude. You don't do that in polite society. You know, these are old cultural myths that go back to what we talked about before, the fact that our society is so heavily biased against emotions and overprivileges rationality. So we're going to use the passive voice, it seems to me like, or it seems like you are. Passive voice is a voice of distance.
Yes.
We separate ourselves. We're separating ourselves because we're self-protective. We're trying to protect ourselves. It's our own anxiety of being worried about how we're going to be perceived. Notice that it's all about me, the listener, not about you, the speaker. And what I teach is you always listen and reflect from the speaker's frame of reference. Mm-hmm. Any reference to you is inappropriate, which is why you always use a you statement. Mm-hmm. And as you observe, rightly, when you start interjecting yourself into this process by distancing yourself, using a passive voice or using an I statement, it will not work. And as soon as you go back to using a you statement, it works. And the only way you can really do that is to do what you did, which is experiment.
Yeah.
And test. And I always tell people, they give me pushback on the on this. I said, hey, you know, don't take it from the great Doug Knoll. Go out and try it yourself. Give it a fair test and see which one works for you. And watch how people respond.
Yeah. We're in a society so starved of people being seen, feeling seen, that I found that it worked even when I made it weaker than need be. And I got lots of compliments about how people felt heard and understood with me. But then I did this, and it's orders of magnitude more powerful.
That's right. Now our brains are hardwired. You're right.
One of the reasons I like meditation so much is that it gives me, it increases a gap between stimulus or trigger and my reaction, or hopefully response. And the more consistent I am, the more I do it, the longer that gap, which gives me control over how I respond to the situation. Are there any other things like that that we can do to increase the effectiveness of this style of communication?
We can calm ourselves by breathing, because if we take slow, deep breaths, it's basically sending signals to the brain and to the rest of the viscera that, hey, everything is cool. I'm not panting, not running. But the problem is it takes too long. Mm-hmm. It works, but it takes too long. And you got to have the presence of mind to start doing deep breathing when you're upset, which most people don't have. They don't have that kind of discipline. So the trick, I think, is to learn how to affect label other people and then begin to self-affect label yourself. Become emotionally aware of your moment-to-moment experience. Mm. And if people want to read more about this, I suggest looking at the work of Lisa Feldman Barrett, who's a neuroscientist and psychologist at the university, at Northeastern University in Boston. And she has really radically changed my ideas about all of this stuff.
Wow.
And a lot of her science is what I've used to develop my thinking on all of this.
When you're trying to calm someone, logic, facts, numbers, and stats don't always have the intended effect. So can you talk to me about the importance of emotion? And I know it's a taboo subject for men to talk about, maybe less so now, but talk to me about emotions in general.
Yeah. So the first thing that I want to say is that we've been lied to for 4,000 years, probably longer than 4,000 years. We've been told by philosophers and theologians that what separates humans from other animals is rationality. And what neuroscience teaches us is there's no such thing as rationality. It's a complete myth. And this lie has been perpetrated for a whole bunch of different reasons, many of them malign. And the truth of the matter is that we are 98% emotional and only 2% rational, assuming we can even define what rationality is. I teach at Pepperdine University, and I teach a course in decision making. And the first thing I ask my students to do is to define rationality. And there is no good definition of rationality. Mm-hmm. So we have this, we built up this big myth that emotions are bad, they're weak, they're evil, they're irrational. For a man, they make you weak, you know, you're a sissy, all that feminine stuff that's anti-masculine, all bullshit. And that single idea by itself has caused more harm and abuse in human history than any other single idea or concept. So the problem that we have is that we got this strong cultural bias against emotions and in favor of this myth of rationality. And it starts at 2 years old. You remember when you were two? You're running around outside and you fall down and you skin your knee and you start to cry. What are you told?
Don't be a baby.
That's right. Suck it up. Don't be a sissy. Don't be a girly girl. Big boys don't cry.
Yeah.
That's called emotional invalidation. And it is the most insidious and pervasive form of abuse that exists, and it happens to every parent, does it, and every child suffers from it. And the science shows that you're destroying the human brain, the baby's brain, when you do that. You're literally destroying the brain. Because from 18 months until about 6 or 7 years old, the emotional centers of our brains have to develop. And the only way they develop is by us learning how to master our emotional experience. We're not born with emotions, by the way. We have to create emotions. And we're born with a thing called affect. We have 9 basic affect. And out of those affect, it's like an artist's palette. And out of these 9 different affects, we create all these things, different combinations of affect that we ultimately call emotion. And we have to learn how to do this. It's a learned skill. And what happens is, in every single family, children are told not to be emotional. Being emotional is bad. It's evil. It's wrong. And every now and then you can have a happy emotion, but not too happy, you know, and heaven help you if you get angry. And so what happens is that we learn to run away from our emotions. We build up these big walls around us where we become emotionally insensitive to ourselves. We become emotionally numb. We become emotionally unavailable to other people. And we are not able to understand or comprehend other people when they are going through an emotional experience. And so we put them down. We pejoratives. You're being irrational. And it just causes huge amount of abuse. Most people are not happy. And why? Because their emotions have been quashed and they can't experience the full essence of who they are as human beings. You know, in the workplace, they're told, don't bring your emotional baggage to the workplace. Well, that's like saying, leave 98% of who you are as a human being out of the doorstep and don't bring it into work. And here's the thing, the skills to master this are easy. Once you learn them, you all of a sudden, emotions are not scary anymore. They're just part of who we are. And it makes it's so easy to navigate through life. And you have happy relationships, you create intimacy in your personal relationships, you become an effective leader, a leader that people will want to follow. Mm. And of course your health increases dramatically because you're no longer repressing or suppressing your emotions or trying to use conscious effort to emotionally self-regulate. It's just, you just naturally do this stuff and it makes your life just so much easier.
Yeah. I heard recently that there's an alternative system to Maslow's hierarchy of needs that actually places emotional health and connection at the very base of the pyramid. And if you think back to a heartbreak or something very traumatic happens to you, you can't eat, you don't feel safe, and all of those are in that system are higher up on the pyramid.
That's right. And you just touched on something that is really important, and that's the concept of emotional safety. Most people have never experienced emotional safety. Mm. Not even as children. And when you have never experienced emotional safety, what do? You become very defensive. And in extreme cases, like you say, you don't eat or you become addicted. You know, you find addictions to get that dopamine release to deal with the pain of not feeling emotionally safe. And so I agree with that statement. I would say foundationally, if we're not emotionally safe, it's just as bad as not being physically safe, probably worse, because we have no resilience.
We're going to make this an action-packed episode, and there's going to be lots of take-homes and things people can do so that they don't have to worry about not having this when they're a child and being doomed for life, because that's simply not the case. But before Correct. We go on to that, I'd like to talk about something that made me realize the importance of childhood emotional safety, and that was the ACEs study.
Yes. All right. The ACEs study, ACEs stands for Adverse Childhood Experience Study. It was conducted, and it's actually still ongoing. It's a longitudinal study that's being conducted by the Kaiser Permanente people down in San Diego, California. I live about 300 miles north of San Diego in California. Kaiser, of course, has its medical model is trying to keep people out of their hospitals. It wants people to be well and keep them out of the hospital. So the researchers got very interested in the relationship between upbringing and later medical outcomes for adults. And what they found was shocking. They created a list of 9 basic adverse childhood experiences. Of course, sexual abuse and physical abuse were 2, but the rest were all emotional abuse of different kinds. And they found that if a child is subjected to 3 adverse childhood experiences, 10 times more likely to be addicted, 100 times more likely to go to prison, the likelihood of having a happy marriage or a happy relationship is very low. And even more scary, these people tend to die from things like cancer and diabetes and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and all these horrible diseases fairly early in life, all going back to just having three ACEs. It's unbelievable. And so if we talk about mind-body peak performance, then that's it starts. It really starts in utero. But it after birth, it becomes that those first 10 years are just critical. And if you've got parent and the problem, here's the problem. 98% of all families are emotionally dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And so children are going to experience adverse childhood experiences, even with families that think they're the most loving parents in the world, because the parents don't know any better.
Yeah.
Just by emotionally invalidating a child, you're creating an adverse childhood experience. And we're looking around, you know, we're talking today, the Uvalde massacre happened a week ago or so. That kid was severely traumatized. And it turns out the all these mass murders, they're looking for violent suicide. That's the way they want to go. And the one thing that links them all together is severe childhood emotional trauma. Mm. And they're not evil monsters. They are seriously deformed and injured human beings that society will not take care of. And their parents won't take care of them either.
It almost seems like it'd be impossible to carry out that study and have a control group, because what households have less than three adverse?
That's a good question. In the Kaiser Permanente database in San Diego, which is a fairly affluent county in California and a large military base, so they got a lot of, they have a very large population of Kaiser Permanente patients. And what they did was send out questionnaires to very lengthy questionnaires to their they screened for what they were looking for in terms of people who were suffering from various types of morbid diseases, and they did a very thorough screening, and then to that population they finally isolated, which is I think was around 28,000, maybe 30,000 people, they sent out questionnaires asking about their childhood experiences, and then they correlated the responses they got with the medical records they had.
Wow.
And that's how they discovered the relationship.
Interesting. So what's happening in the brain when someone's experiencing trauma or emotional neglect or invalidation?
Well, a couple of things happen. First, of course, this is all on a continuum, and it depends on the severity, but we have neural circuits that involve areas of the brain called the limbic system, and people have probably heard of the amygdala. There are two of them, amygdalae. And so repeated exposure to emotional abuse in childhood stops the proper development of the emotional centers of the brain. So that's number one. Number two, if the abuse is sufficiently severe, then you can get into post-traumatic stress disorder, which is really a hyperactive amygdala that becomes just reacts at anything because it's hypervigilant. And at the same time, the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, which is our executive function of our brain, doesn't learn how to control everything. It's the air traffic controller, right? And so if you're constantly exposed to this kind of abuse, you really never learn how to get every part of your brain working together properly. And these are all these things you have to learn as a child. You're not born with this stuff. And so the more abuse there is, the less likely that there's going to be, for example, what's known as override, the override function, which is where you move from your fast reactive thinking to your more conservative deliberative thinking. And kids just don't learn to do that. And I've seen this thousands of times with my students in prison, and they've all had the same problem. And that's why they're in prison. And the thing that's really frightening to me is that I talk about this all the time, and parents are just not, 20 people in their 20s and 30s that have young children have no interest in this knowledge. You would think that they would just want to suck this in and start changing the way they are, but they don't. I don't know why. It's really crazy. I believe that if every parent learned the stuff that I teach, that we wouldn't have prisons in 20 years. But young parents just, they're overwhelmed, you know, and they just basically were parenting the way they were parented, and these new ideas are very difficult for them to, even though they're simple ideas and simple practices, just the thought of trying to do something different is...
It's a radical paradigm change, and if you're focusing on saving up for your potential kids' college and other expenses, and you want to be there and go to their things, it's hard to remember that perhaps more important than any of this is actually the way they're raised and the way they're validated. I want to push back on something you said, because this was my honest belief many years ago, and that was that humans are all emotional and not rational and logical, because there's a lot of people out there who consider themselves the type A data analysts. I mean, I'm a data scientist, so I like to think that I use data, but there's a deeper layer than that.
That's right. You can't even begin to analyze data or make what we would call a rational decision until you're emotional first. And why is that? Because how would you know, how do you know when, let's take your work as a data scientist. How would you even know what data is relevant and what data is not relevant unless you had an emotional reaction that made you pay attention to both the good data and the bad data? Yeah. It's emotions that allow us to discriminate and make selections. And we don't make selections based on logic or reasoning. We make selections based on how we feel. What are our emotional experiences? And then, you know, in science, we use the scientific method to double check our work to make sure that we are not engaged in emotional reasoning, which is not good either. So critical thinking, scientific method, all these tools that we have available to us to learn are useful to help us validate and double check our thinking. But it all originates with emotions. Einstein was really, he said something very interesting. He said, I never came up with one of my ideas or theorems through logic.
Really?
Never. Logic got me nowhere. It was all through my, what he called his intuition, which is the emotional side of your thinking.
The way I've heard it described is that humans make decisions based on emotion. And then later we go back and to ourselves and to other people, we justify with logic and rationality.
That's right. The rule that I teach all of my students is you cannot solve an emotional problem with logic. Hmm. You have to use emotional tools when you've got an emotional problem. And you cannot, the second rule is de-escalate before you problem solve. Too many people want to jump into problem solving while somebody's really angry. And that just makes the angry person even angrier. So you've got to calm them down. Then you can problem solve.
Okay, Doug, let's get into that. That is, you set the stage nicely for this, but how do you go about de-escalating?
So all of this, whether you're de-escalating or calming a child down or teaching a child about emotional competency, is a three-step process. Easy to describe, but you got to practice it. So step number one is that, let's assume you're dealing with an angry person of some kind. First thing you're going to do is ignore those angry words. That just becomes white noise. You're not going to ignore the person. You're just going to ignore the words. You've heard it all before. There's nothing new here. You can afford to not listen to the words. And when you do that, two things happen. One, you turn off your triggers, so you're not going to get triggered yourself. And two, you free up bandwidth to do the next two steps. So the first thing you have to master is how to ignore angry words. When somebody's shouting and screaming at you and epithets and vile words and telling you how awful you are, you just ignore it. Then the second step is to read the emotional data fields. You'll like this, you're a data scientist. Emotions are data, just like numbers on a spreadsheet. And we have an innate capacity as human beings to read that data, analyze it, interpret it, and understand it effortlessly. and quickly. And let me just explain why we develop this. Most people don't know that humans only developed language about 230,000 years ago. So for millions of years before that, our hominid predecessors communicated, but they didn't communicate with words. They communicated with emotions, facial expressions and grunts and body language. So our brains are highly, highly attuned to reading the emotions of other people around us. All we have to do is pay attention. So the way you pay attention is simply this angry person is screaming, yelling at you. You just be silent and just empty your consciousness of thoughts. And within a couple of seconds, you'll start, emotional words will start coming to you. Now I teach us, you've probably heard of data structuring in the brain structuring, structured information versus unstructured information. The brain does really well when you can structure it. And I have there are six layers of emotions that I teach people to listen for, these six layers. And that gives them some structure so that when the emotions start coming in, they just slot it into one of these layers, and it becomes very easy to do that. So now you've ignored the words, you're reading the emotional data fields. And then the third step, the last step, and this is where the magic is to reflect back the speaker's emotions with a simple you statement. Nick, you're really pissed off. You're really angry. You don't feel appreciated. You don't feel supported. You feel like you've been treated really unfairly. And you're a little concerned and anxious. And the whole thing makes you sad. You feel betrayed. And you're a little embarrassed. And you feel like you've been completely abandoned and left alone and not loved. And the whole thing just really pisses you off. So every single one of those statements was a you statement describing an emotional experience that you might be having if you're really angry. And what the science shows, this is out of Matthew Lieberman's lab at UCLA, 2007 brain scanning study, is that when you engage in this process called affect labeling, the emotional centers of the brain, the amygdala and all those other neural circuits that are involved with emotions, are inhibited. At the same time, the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex that I talked about earlier is activated. And you're actually able to calm down an angry person in about 90 seconds. And it happens every single time with every single human being, because we're all hardwired for this. It's absolutely amazing to watch.
That's incredible. And especially that it works so quickly. It works on everyone and in just 90 seconds.
And it works on people. People can have brain dysfunctions and it still works. They can be on the autistic spectrum. They can have Alzheimer's. They can have ADHD. I mean, it works on every single human brain. And it's not cultural. It's not culturally based. It works in anywhere. Because all human brains are essentially the same.
Since I learned that from you, I started practicing it in my everyday life.
And what happened?
It usually works great, and people feel seen. You can tell that they just light up when you are able to affect label them properly. Except I had one encounter, I think it was 2 days ago, where I was told not to do that, and that they took offense to me labeling.
So let me explain what happened. You'll get that every now and then. You were too good. You were too effective. Remember I talked about the walls we build around us?
Yeah.
What you did is you affect labeled that person and you penetrated right through their walls like a superhero and saw them for who they really were, and it scared the crap out of them. Mm-hmm. And that's where the pushback came from. So the way you deal with that when you get it is to back off and be very conversational and subtle. So rather than go through a full affect label, you might say, you're really frustrated, and just drop it. Don't say another word. And make it as conversational and as subtle and light as you can, and then be very careful in your observation. What goes on with the behavior? And you'll see that even though they told you not to do it, they will still have that sense of validation, what I call listening other people into existence, that you've experienced.
Okay.
So you did nothing wrong. And there's nothing wrong with the technique. It's just that you were too good.
Yeah. And after that happened, I was like, oh, this doesn't work. So I threw it out, went back to my old habits. But now I know just to adapt.
Yeah. Yeah, it does work. And the fact of the matter is, I don't know how many other times you've tried it, but you know, one out of 100 is going to give you pushback, maybe. And the other thing is that you don't want to use this until you get good at it. You don't want to bring it into a marriage or a partnership, an intimate partnership. You want to, because there, we all construct certain rules in our relationships, and this will disrupt the rules. So you got to be very careful about how you use this stuff. It's very powerful. So I always tell people, go to Starbucks. You go up and to the barista and you're putting in your order. Look at the barista and say, hey, you look really happy today. You're really happy today. And they almost always are, because Starbucks hires personable people. And just watch what happens. And they'll light up. And they'll tell you their whole life story and piss off everybody behind you in the line. And you'll have to affect label your way out the door. But yeah, practice in really low-risk social situations. Starbucks, coffee shops, restaurants, checkout in the supermarket. People who are perfect strangers, give them one throwaway emotion that you're picking up. And just imagine them as lab rats, and you've got your white coat on, and you're just testing the concept. And over a period of a couple of weeks, as you make a habit of doing this, a couple of things will occur. One, you'll see that, yes, this really does work, and your confidence level will go up. But more importantly, it becomes a self-affirming practice, because people are, you've witnessed this, when people feel deeply listened to, they feel heard, they feel validated, they're grateful that you've taken the time to truly listen them into existence. And that gratitude that you get back builds your confidence. And it feels good to do it. So you want to continue doing it. And the other thing that happens is that now, as you practice this on other people, you start becoming more emotionally self-aware. You're affect labeling other people. Now you can start to begin to feel your own emotions more clearly and understand your own emotional experience. And that allows you to emotionally self-regulate. And voila. Emotional intelligence. You've just developed your emotional intelligence. All from listening to the emotions of other people.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it, because learning to feel your own emotions, to experience them, can be difficult, especially if you don't grow up doing that. But as you just mentioned, that I've noticed in my own personal experience that when I practice this, and I've done it many times, probably 50 times, and I've only had a negative response one time. But I notice that I'm becoming more aware as I start getting triggered, so that I don't lash out in ways that I will later regret.
Exactly. So as you engage in this practice, you're developing your own emotional intelligence, and that's calming you down, so you become more centered. And you'll start to see people around you that you interact with as emotional beings, not rational beings. And you'll no longer use the term irrational. You say, they're just being emotional. I know how to deal with that. And all of a sudden, you start having compassion for people. And they're not crazy-making anymore. You just understand what's going on.
How do you go about completely ignoring the words they use? Are you not getting any subtle cues as to what the underlying hurt is or underlying cause of the emotion is by listening to the words?
Ms. Rabian's 1960 study shows that only 7% of any human communication is composed of content. 93% is all nonverbal. Primarily facial expressions, eyes in particular, and voice tonality and speed and volume. And that's where we're picking up our emotional cues. And our brains, we literally have areas in our brain that pick up on those cues and translate it into understanding somebody else's experience. It's called theory of mind. And there are all kinds of brain systems. It's quite complex, more complex than I understand, but I just know that at a high level that our brains are capable of doing this. And there are neuroscientists who are studying this stuff to try to understand it in more detail.
That makes me think of trying to apply this to text message conversations, because I've done that, but it also, it's very hard to ignore the words, because that's all, I mean, maybe that's not all, but that's the majority of what you are taking in. You can feel something about the messages without even really knowing what the words say, just based on like the back and forth, the timing and everything, whether there's emojis or not. But either way, it's hard to ignore the content.
Right. And so that's why it takes some practice doing this verbally for a while, because then when you move to text or email, yeah, you get some bile message or something, but somebody's being snarky, or they're being mean, or they're just And then, oh, this person's just being emotional. And when you say they're just being emotional, then you can say, oh, so I wonder what the emotions are. Well, you're not there present, but you can, after a while, you get so good at this that you recognize the repertoire of human behavior around emotion is really very limited. I mean, really limited. And you start seeing the same patterns over and over and over again. So in text messaging, you'll see the anger. It's almost always anger. Sometimes it's people are sad, but it's always fundamental. And then you just affect label back. You know, I mean, I've got a lot of social media platforms, and people give, when I bother to reply, when people give me snarky comments on Facebook or YouTube, you know, I affect label them. You're frustrated. You don't feel heard. You don't feel listened to. You feel disrespected. You feel disempowered. And the whole thing just really pisses you off. And they go away.
Yeah.
They go away.
I notice that when I'm speaking and having a conversation in person, it's easy for me to hear the angry words and justify it as, oh, they're just having an emotional moment right now. But then when I text or email and I reread the same line over and over again, it's hard to let it go.
Right. So just more practice. You've been doing this for a month or so since we chatted, and it takes a little time to develop this. So just keep working on it. And every day you work on it, it gets easier and easier and easier. It's like any other skill. It just takes practice.
Okay. Tell me about some of the other conflict systems and what they get wrong, because your approach runs perpendicular to what I've heard many other times.
The reason I developed all of this was because as a mediator and peacemaker, I was being paid a lot of money to walk into really hot disputes. And I had to have ways of calming people down that worked. And even though I have a master's degree and a law degree, nothing in my academic training taught me anything that worked. I was taught, like many people, the old Thomas Gordon active listening stuff using I statements. And it turns out, of course, that doesn't work, never has, never will. It's still being taught. I can't believe it is being taught, but even though everybody knows it's not effective, it's a complete misreading of what Gordon was a psychologist at the PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was a student of Carl Rogers, the great 20th century humanist psychologist. And he posited that a lot of conflict was caused by people using you statements. You son of a bitch, why did you do that to me? You know, that kind of thing. And so he started recommending that people start using an I statement. And he was right. If I'm going to express my emotions to you, Nick, I'm going to use I. I'm going to say, I am, Nick, when you didn't bring the pizza over like you said, I became really frustrated because, you know, we were having a bunch of guys over for beer, and without the pizza, the party was going to be a big bust. All right, so I'm using an I statement, and I'm not blaming you, but I'm just calling out, when you failed to do X, I felt Y, because of Z. That's what Gordon taught, and he was absolutely right about that. The problem is that the human potential movement that started in the late 50s and early 60s completely misconstrued his training, completely misunderstood it. And then it got into the therapy world, where it got locked into concrete, and it got locked into concrete in the mediation world, and everybody started teaching these I statements, which don't work. They don't work for a lot of reasons. And so that's where a lot of the conflict comes in. So then you get to nonviolent communication, which is now called compassionate communication. And the guy that developed that was also a psychologist, PhD out of the University of Wisconsin at Madison, about 20 years behind Gordon. And I did a very detailed study of Gordon's work versus nonviolent communication, wrote a long article on my website about it. And as far as I can tell, basically nonviolent communication is a rebranding of Gordon's work. They're almost identical in terms of how the formulaic way they use. But, you know, nonviolent communication doesn't work. I know there are people who are just rabid adherents to it and would probably shoot me for keep throwing stones at it, but it doesn't work. If it worked, I wouldn't be talking about this. I'd be using it. And I would certainly be teaching it in prison, where violence is endemic. And when I'm teaching peacemakers in prison, I've got to give them tools that work the first time, every time, without fail, because lives are at stake. And so it's got to work. And NBC will not work.
Yeah. I mean, that's a testament in itself. If you're able to use these tools with people who need it most and they consistently get results where other systems don't, it's worth at least trying for a while to see how it works for us personally.
Well, yeah. I mean, the first prison that Laurel and I went into was the largest, most violent women's prison in the world, Valley State Prison for Women. And we started in April of 2010 with 15 women. Within 2 years, we got a letter from the warden, unsolicited, saying, this is no longer a violent prison because of the work that you're doing.
Incredible.
Yeah, and this happens all the time. I mean, we've replicated it in, like I said, 40, 50 prisons around the world. Same effect.
Doug, you mentioned that your affect palette has 9 different items on it. What are those?
See if I can remember them off the top of my head. We have two positive affect, excitement and joy. We have 1 neutral affect, which is surprise, startle. And then we have 6 negative affect. And those are anger, rage, fear, all the fear affect, which leads to all the fear emotions. We have disgust, dismal, shame, humiliation, embarrassment. So interestingly, we have 6 negatives and only 2 positives. The 2 positives are based on the dopaminergic system, dopamine, which is our pleasure system. Surprise, startle is cortisol, you know, we get jacked up. And then we have all these negative affect that are there for self-protective reasons. You know, you have this smell, which is what the feeling you get when you smell spoiled milk. You have disgust, which keeps you from eating bad food, but also the brain has co-opted disgust to be disgust towards a human being for behavior. Obviously, fear. Anger is obvious. Anger, rage. And so forth and so on. And now you've got this palette of 9 affect that we're all born with this. And starting at about 18 months of age, just as we start to verbalize, now we have to learn how to take all this affective experience that we have and turn it into emotions. And the reason that human beings can do this and no other animal can do it is because when we create emotions, something really powerful things happen. 1, we concretize the affect into consciousness. So now we're aware. We can now become self-aware. I'm angry. 2, I can start drawing inferences about what caused that anger. Who just pissed me off and why? Right? 3, I can make choices around the anger using the ventrolateral prefrontal cortex. And 4, I can communicate my anger to another person. If I didn't have emotion, I would simply react to the affect based on whatever either genetic programming I had or learned programming I had. And I would not, that deliberative ability to self-regulate, self-modulate, and be aware and communicate would not exist. And that's why humans have emotions. That's what separates us from other animals. Dogs don't have emotions. Dogs only have affect. Cats don't have emotions. They have affect. And we anthropomorphize them and read into them emotions, but they're not able to communicate. They're not able to self-regulate. They're not able to do any of this stuff that we can do as humans with emotions. And that's the difference.
What's your view on negations and communication strategies around that? For example, I discovered that instead of saying no to something and dismissing it, if I instead talk about what's preventing me from saying yes, that tends to work.
My first hit on that is that if you start talking about and thinking about why can't I say yes, you're invoking what's known as your system 2 thinking. System 1 and system 2. These were terms that have been around in decision-making theory for a long time, but Daniel Kahneman, the Nobel laureate, really popularized the concept in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow. So if you just say no, you're using system 1. System 1 will only look for evidence to confirm the no. But if you go to why can't I say yes, that invokes your system two thinking, which is much slower and more deliberate, and allows you to examine all the evidence and not just the evidence that's confirmatory. So that's really a good practice to engage in, to say, why can't I say yes? Because then it forces you to look at, in a critical way, using critical thinking, what the real issues are.
Yeah. And I recently interviewed Mark England of Enlifted, and we talked all about how your words and thoughts shape your stories, which shapes your reality. And one of the big takeaways is that to your brain and body, a no, I don't want something, you end up creating what you don't want. If you say, I don't want to go to the party, you're thinking about going to the party.
Because our brains are reality creating machines. They're designed to create reality. When you think about it, all the information that we take in is all vibrational. So it's all energy. So for example, sight is electromagnetic energy. Sound is physical energy through the air that goes into our ears. Taste is chemical, nose is chemical. Sense of touch can be physical and chemical. And these are all these energies are what our environment is all about. And our whole being is designed to take all this energy in and create a reality that makes sense to us, that allows us to survive.
Okay, Doug, we're going to start to slowly wrap up. But if people are interested in your work, picking up your book, taking your course, or connecting with you, how do they find you?
Email, doug@dougknoll.com, and I'm a solopreneur, so I answer all my own emails. I don't have a virtual assistant. I don't have any entourage, so you get what you see. I also created a page, which is now active, that I told you I would, for everybody who's listening, and that URL is dougknoll.co, nick-urban.
Slash?
So, yeah, there's a slash after the code. My website is dougknoll.com, but this is just a shortened link to the webpage that I've created for your audience that has, you can get a copy of my fourth book, Deescalate. You can get a free ebook that really talks about and lays out everything we've talked about today. And you can get access to a couple of my online video courses. And of course, you'll also be on the website, so you can, there's a ton of resources on the website, articles and YouTubes and stuff like that. And you can go to my YouTube channel. I started a new YouTube channel a couple of weeks ago called The Power of Emotional Competence. So if you want to check that out, for today, for example, my project is to do a YouTube channel on empathy, sympathy, and compassion. Mm. Everybody gets that confused. Even psychologists get it confused. And so I'm going to do a YouTube and kind of set the record straight on what they all are and and the different kind of practices that they all involve.
I was using them interchangeably until a couple of weeks ago.
So no, they're very different.
Yeah.
Very different. Sympathy is the worst. Of course, that's speaker oriented, making the speaker. Sympathy is a way of saying, oh, I'm so sorry for what you felt. But notice there's the I statement in there. So it's really all about me, and I'm just soothing my own anxiety over your distress. Empathy is the ability to read, interpret, assimilate, and reflect back the emotional experience of another person. And there are two kinds of empathy, affective empathy and cognitive empathy. I teach cognitive empathy first, and then if you practice it, you'll develop affective empathy. Cognitive empathy is the ignore the words, read the emotional data fields, reflect back the emotions with a you statement. Affective empathy is the same thing, but it's much faster because instead of reading the emotional data fields, you're actually experiencing what the other person is experiencing much faster. And then you can do the same reflection. But you develop affective empathy automatically as you practice cognitive empathy. And then compassion develops from cognitive and affective empathy. And what compassion is, it's the ability to not only understand the emotional experience another person is having and reflect it, but having a compulsion to help and not engage in self-soothing, but actually do something to relieve distress. So that's the difference between the three in a nutshell.
Quick little exercise for us. I got an email from a podcast guest today that she had to cancel. She was sick. And I told her that I was sorry she wasn't feeling well and that I hope she got better soon. What would have been the better response there?
You're feeling really frustrated that you're sick. You were really excited about coming on the show, and you're disappointed that we have to reschedule, and you're feeling a little anxious that I might be upset about that. And you're hopeful that we can reschedule, and you're hopeful that you'll get well quickly so you'll feel better. See the difference?
Yeah, it sounds scary to write that and not know how she'd react, but I can see how it could be comforting.
It's very powerful. We're so afraid of emotions, we're afraid to tell people what they feel.
Yeah.
Because we're afraid of the emotions ourselves. And once we overcome that fear and start this practice, everything changes. Everything changes.
I'm excited to start applying that to emails as well, because I haven't been
Absolutely.
Doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, Doug. Imagine there's a burning of the books and all knowledge on earth is gone. You get to save the works of three teachers. Who would you choose and why?
Oh my God. Lisa Feldman Barrett. Yeah, I would keep her book, The Secret Life of the Brain, or How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. The other book I would keep, which is going to be interesting, is a very thick, dense textbook called Neuroeconomics. And the reason that I would keep that is because it captures the knowledge of how the brain makes decisions and is the science behind decision making. And then I want to pick a more meditative book. Maybe something like Khalil Gibran, the Prophet, Four Agreements, maybe. Ruiz. Something like that. I'd have to think about it. But I'd definitely pick two science books and one philosophical book.
I like that. All right, let's move on to a quick rapid fire round now.
Okay.
What are the biggest myths around communication?
That it's all about speaking. And it's really, really communication is all about listening and knowing what to listen for.
What do you listen for?
Well, you know, you can listen to words. You can listen to meaning. And you can listen to emotions. And we're taught to listen to words. We're not taught how to listen for meaning. And we're not taught how to listen for emotions. So we've lost 90% of what we're supposed to be listening for. Good communication is based on good listening.
What areas of your own communication are you working on currently?
I'm always working on my listening. And I'm also working on I'm a really strong writer. But I'm always working on my writing. How do I convey these complex ideas quickly and simply so that people who don't have a lot of time can get what I'm talking about and understand it? That's why I love LinkedIn. I get to write a 400 word essay. And in 400 words, I've got to convey some kind of complex idea in a way that's engaging to people on LinkedIn.
That's the old Richard Feynman principle of when you write something, you're forced to consolidate and organize your thoughts.
Right.
And then even more so when someone else is going to be learning from your work.
Right. And you have to create it in a way that gives you credibility and does not take away from the reader's experience of drawing conclusions. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to draw conclusions for the reader. You want to give the reader access points to decide your credibility as a thought leader.
Final question. What's one thing that your tribe does not know about you?
So much. Most people really don't know how disabled I was as a child. And it's only recently that I've started talking about it. And I was prompted to start talking about it by some friends who said, you know, that's what makes you really interesting, is that you had a really tough, brutal childhood. Even though you grew up in affluence and love, and it was still brutal, and you've managed to accomplish so much. So most people look at me as a mature adult, accomplished academically, professionally, but don't realize that, I struggled for decades.
A lot to unpack there. We can probably do a whole episode about that. We kind of just glossed over it in the interest of time. But yeah, that's not something that I would have had any idea just looking and hearing from you.
Right.
Okay. Any final thoughts that you want to leave listeners with today?
I just hope that for everybody who's listening, that this has inspired you to maybe go out and start learning how to listen to emotions and reflect and overcome the innate fear that we have around telling other people how they feel. That's been programmed into us, and we got to overcome that programming and start listening people into existence. Start throwing that pebble into the pond of peace and start creating ripples in your own life. And just watch how your life will transform magically in really a matter of weeks.
So quick.
So quick. Very fast.
Okay. Well, Doug, thank you for your time today. It's been a pleasure chatting with you and hosting you on the Mind Body Peak Performance podcast.
Well, thank you, Nick.
Until next time, I'm Nick Urban here with Doug Knoll, signing out from mindbodypeak.com. Have a great week and be an outlier. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/ and then the number of the episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.